My word. A panel game devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Pahl and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which is this week about words that are descriptive of various intellectual faculties or activities. Two marks for the meaning of the words I'm going to give now. Frank Muir, lucubration, L-U-C-U-B-R-A-T-I-O-N, lucubration.
It means it's the process of writing short stories about Welshmen. It's very tiring because it's always look you. But it also means writing them late into the night, burning the midnight oil, because it means writing or thinking or pronouncing far into the night.
Absolutely right. Any bit of study or meditation or writing perfected late into the night, and as the 18th century phrase was, you usually produced a composition which smelled of the lamp. To work by lamplight is the Latin original, two marks. Anne Scott James, apperception, A-P-P-E-R-C-E-P-T-I-O-N, apperception.
Oh, that's very difficult. I suppose you split it after. Oh, we got the Welsh again, don't we? Under the apperception. Well, it must be some kind of... it's a mental process or mental receptivity.
Yes, of something.
Apples.
A bit nearer
home. Got any views?
A bit nearer
home.
Yeah.
I mean, it's app we're looking for, is it?
Yeah. That's right, yes. It's an ad or app perception, yes.
Is it the state of perceiving? Is it?
That's right.
Readiness.
Yes, that's half of it.
Sensitivity to...
Yes, but what you're looking at, this is very internal seeming.
Inside yourself.
That's right.
Narcissist sort of... Oh, yeah. You've got it, have you?
Intellectually, mm-hmm. Don't think about...
Intellectual narcissism.
Ha! Oh, dear.
Oh, well, wait a moment, let's have another go. It was the opposite to being outlooking, to being inward-looking, is it?
Yes, you're getting awfully close. I don't think I can give you more than one and a half, Anne.
All right.
It's the mind's perception or awareness of itself as a conscious agent, thinking things and doing things. It's a particular kind of self-consciousness. And
you'd very likely to disappear suddenly up your own awareness.
A remark which almost any respectable philosopher would reject, but still we go on. Dennis Norden, polemics.
Oh, polemics is a word I find distasteful. It's a word that was invented by politicians to dignify the kind of brawling they go in for up to the status of a skill or an art. It's debating at the top of one's voice.
Yes, I think that's very good indeed, Dennis. Two marks straight away. The practice of controversial argument, it happened particularly in the old days in theology. I don't know if the theologians do it so much now. And doing it, as Dennis Cartwright says, in a thoroughly aggressive manner. Two marks. Dennis Powell.
Sophistry.
Sophistry implies a kind of falseness that you're disguising something under other words.
Yes, that'll do. This is a word which has gone downhill. It originally referred to a class of paid public teachers who taught rhetoric and philosophy in ancient Greece, and they, some of them, cheated, as Tillis suggests, and therefore were examples of specious but fallacious reasoning and often intending to deceive. Two marks, Tillis.
That's what might be termed a fun round.
Yes. Well, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you've been given for the last round of all. And, Frank, yours is, "There's a breathless hush in the close tonight." And yours, Dennis, is, "Two's company, three's a crowd. Well, now we have a round of popular misquotations, that is, of sayings which are probably more often wrongly than rightly quoted.
This is the programme.
2 marks, if you can correct the error. Frank Muir, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well.
That's not right.
No?
No, that's wrong. It's alas, poor Charlie, I knew him.
No.
Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, comma, yeah. Horatio.
Well done. We're really well
a
done.
Fellow of infinite jest.
Hamlet at the graveside is not soliloquizing here. He's talking to Horatio, and Frank is absolutely dead right. What he says is, alas, poor Yorick, holding the skull in his hand, I knew him, Horatio. 2 marks.
Have we got out damn spot?
No, not this time.
Oh, what a pity.
It's all a pity.
I know that one, too.
And Pastures New?
Yes. Not Pastures New.
No, more. We haven't got any Milton at all. And no more Shakespeare.
A little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
No, we haven't got Pope either.
I was waiting for that.
Well, fire away, Jack, what you have got.
I'll do my best. And this is for Anne Scott-James. Money is the root of all evil.
Oh, well, I think I do know this one. I think it's the love of money, isn't it?
Yes.
It's the root of all evil.
Yeah.
And it's biblical.
Yep. Yeah. It's St. Paul in the Epistle of Paul to Timothy, chapter 6, verse 10. The love of money is the root of all evil. 2 marks.
There's nothing wrong with money itself.
No.
out, damn pin spot.
Was it John Mason Brown who said, the greatest handicap we shoulder our children with is endeavouring to teach them that money isn't everything.
I very like that very much indeed. It's now Dennis Norton's turn. He that agrees against his will is of his own opinion still.
One of the troubles with that is that I've never heard it before. In any
Not
form, right or wrong. Do you know it?
I'll tell you, it
comes in your life. Eh?
It comes in Hudibras, so I'll give you that. But then
I don't care if it comes in dark green with matching accessories. I've never heard it, Jack, so I really can't help you with it.
Try and guess which word is wrong.
Well, it sounds all right, doesn't it?
Yes,
sounds,
makes sense. I've been looking.
Well, give me a synonym for agree.
Agrees, yes. He that gives in against his will.
Something that sort.
Yield. No,
that's again.
Two syllables. No.
Yes, that's right.
It makes sense as it is, doesn't it? He that agrees against his will. Can you agree?
Conforms.
Against your will?
Conforms.
One. You're getting quite close. It should be he that complies against his will is of his own opinion still. That is, he's being sulky and still thinking what he did think, though he doesn't say so. It comes from Samuel Butler's Hudibras. And now on to Dilys Powell. When Greek meets Greek.
Oh, this one?
No.
Joins Greek.
Frank says it means joins Greek.
Yes,
right.
How many Greeks would you like to have?
Starts the
Greek,
tug of war.
One Greek.
No, I. We know a lot of Greeks.
Not with the tug of war.
Yes.
But when Greek.
Joins.
Greek.
Then starts the tug of war.
Is it?
Yes, but you don't have a team of only
Greeks.
Two in the tug of war.
No.
That's right.
Greeks.
Yes, I think you creep home. It's when Greeks join Greeks, then was the tug of war, and it's a rather sort of not terribly well-known playwright called Nathaniel Lee. And my sources are at variance on this. Some say it comes from a play of his called The Rival Queens. The others say it comes from a play of his called The Alexander the Great, so I don't know which. Anyway, 2 marks. Well, now, a quick round of terminology supposed to be used, or actually used, by tramps. Words from their private language, which they have in order to defeat the rest of us. And I want, for 2 marks, you to hazard a guess at what these might mean in everyday English. Frank Muir, you start, and yours is a cackleberry. B-E-R-R-Y. Cackleberry.
A nice word, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Well, a cackler was thieves' slang for cant, for an actor. So a cackleberry is a raspberry blown at an actor.
Give it wings. Not very useful wings, Frank. Cackleberry.
Winged raspberry.
Some sort of like a flea.
No, no.
Flea. It hasn't got any flea, it's got wings.
No. A bird. Ladybird. No. Ladybird is not unlike a raspberry. Quite a very, very, very small
raspberry.
Not useful
wings. Perhaps it means an angel.
No.
An angel.
It doesn't...
Angels don't care.
It tends not to take off from the ground, though it might be in your backyard. And Frank's got 10 of them, I think.
The bird with feathers of
hens. Oh, cackleberry, hen food.
Hen.
Yes, all right.
Hen food.
Give it its ordinary name.
Chicken.
Chicken. An egg.
Egg it is, like hen fruit, 1.5.
Samuel Butler the Second, not the Hudibras man, wrote that a hen is only an egg's way of making another egg.
Yes.
Yes, it's the latest advance in genetic science.
That's right, it is. It's
taken 100 years to work that one.
Anne Scott James, your phrase is to sling the guff, G-U-W-F, to sling the guff.
To broadcast.
Well, it could be that.
Is it tramp?
I think it means there's a vile housewife in this house who, if you knock on the door, will throw you out. Therefore, move on to the next cottage.
But what you're doing...
she's going to throw the slops at you.
No, this is the...
What the tramp's going to do.
The active partner is the tramp.
It's the tramp.
And the housewife is only, as it were, the receptionist.
Oh, he's going to tell her an awful sad tale.
Absolutely right. To sling the guff is to tell a hard luck story to somebody you hope you can get money or food from. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, to spend the night with Mrs. Greenfield.
I presume if you slung the guff successfully enough... It could be a rather poetic way of saying to sleep in the open air in the country.
Absolutely right. That's quite right, yes.
I like the story of the lady who said to the tramp, who asked her something to eat, "Do you like cold rice pudding?" And he said, "Oh, yes, very much, ma'am." She said, "Will you come back in about 3 hours? It's hot at the moment."
Well, to spend the night in Mrs. Greenfield, or sometimes to spend the night in Mrs. Green, is, I think, a New Zealand tramp's expression, and it's the English one, which you use quite often, is Star Hotel, which is much the same thing.
That's nice.
Now, Dennis Powell, yours is a hay burner, H-A-Y hyphen, burner. A hay burner.
Hay burner. Something to do with a night out, no? Nothing to do with a night out.
Nothing, I think.
No,
yeah, a night out.
A night in.
What a night... No, I should be giving it away if I say that. What is quite often associated with a night?
Cold.
Yes, sleeping.
Or heat.
Sleeping.
K.
A knight?
Yes.
A knight.
Oh, a night burner.
A knight burner.
How did you get around?
On a horse.
That's what I wanted.
He wants a horse. A horse.
A knight burner is a horse.
I haven't the faintest idea why.
I don't
believe
it.
But I am told that this tramp's expression, a hay burner, refers to a horse, and you can leave out the knight. That's all right. But there it is.
A hay burner.
A banner, 2 marks.
Mind you, if you bump up and down, practicing trotting when you're not very good at it, it produces heat and agony.
So
and
it does.
Anyway, 2 marks. So we come to the last round, and to Frank and Dennis's quotations, and the marks will be awarded on the length of the applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Frank, you remember your quotation is, "There's a breathless hush in the close tonight," which is a poem by Henry Newbolt. I think the series was called Vitae Lampada, and if anybody wants to come round to me afterwards to get the translation, I'll give it to them. But, Frank.
If Sir Henry Newbolt was to enter the studio this evening and say, "Are you all sitting comfortably?" I would say, "Yes, I am, sir. I am Sir Henry. For the first time in my life, I'm sitting comfortably. I really am, sir." Because it's this underclothing thing, isn't it? They are really most frightfully badly designed. The Greeks didn't have underclothing. and warring people. There were efforts made, you know, in medieval times or the late 15th century, in the Teutonic areas of Europe. Experiments were made with a great innovationist in making metal underpants for men. There were experiments conducted by a man you probably heard of. He was the founder of modern astronomy, called Copernicus. But men didn't need them, you see. And you take warring people like the Scottish clans. I mean, they were tough. They had these heavy kilts around them, you know. And when they went to sleep at night, they just pull off their plaid cloak, wring it out in the icy waters of a burn, wrap it round them and go to sleep. You know, and they were the founders of the Coldstream Guards. And your ordinary Scotsman with his kilt didn't wear anything beneath it, and it didn't need to, except in the icy parts of winter, when more elderly Scotsmen could be seen gathered together on the grill above the baker's shop in Prince's Road. But when I was a young lad, one wore underpants made of knitted wool. They were all right, except they itched. My early childhood was spent rushing around Broadstairs and trying to find an empty place in the bandstand or something to have a good scratch with these woolly underpants. But now I wear what are called briefs. They have French name like and Louis, and they cost the earth, and they come in three sizes, too small, too large, and the intermediate size, which I have, which is too small when you buy them, and too large after three washes. And today I got absolutely fed up, and I thought I'd invent a proper, not a pair of anything, but just one of it. So what I did, I thought about the problem, and I went to our local material shop in Egham this morning, and I bought a square yard of fine toweling. Now, I admit this is cotton as well, but this toweling is marvellous stuff because it's got thousands of little cotton ears all over it, which make it feel soft. And I studied the geometry of the problem, and what I did was I folded the square into a triangle. And then I wrapped it round my waist, as it were the hypotenuse going round my waist. And then I bent down and dragged the third corner underneath the arches, as it were. And I tied the three ends together with a large safety pin. And that was sort of semi-successful, but I found as I moved around that the whole thing was beautifully soft and wasn't harsh at all, but it swiveled a bit and failed to perform its function. And So then I had an inspiration, and I went and got a smallish conker from the garden and pierced it and straightened out a safety pin and pushed that through it. And I put the conker inside the waistband of the thing and tied it to the safety pin. Now, you know, the tummy button is a much underestimated part of the human being. Nobody knows what it's for. When I was young, in fact, humiliatingly recently, I thought that if you unscrewed your tummy button, your bottom fell off. But I've since discovered this is only an old wives' tale. But it is a beautiful dent, and I found that by having this conker fixed inside the waistband of this triangular piece of it settled into the tummy button, you know, like as though into a socket, and the whole thing was steadied, and it's been beautiful all day, and it is beautiful tonight, and it's not a pair of knickers, it's a knicker or a pant. It's only one of them, or a brief. And that's why if Sir Henry Newbolt came in now and said, "Are you sitting comfortably?" I would say, "Yes, sir. Yes, Sir Henry, I am. Although it isn't apparent, Sir Henry, because I'm fully dressed. There's a brief less harsh in the clothes tonight."
I hope no enthusiastic mum will start fitting her baby's nappies with conkers after that story. And we go on to Dennis. And if you remember, his proverb was, two's company, three's a crowd.
Well, now, in the first place, you must remember that not only had I just come out of the RAF, but I was now really getting rather desperate for a job. So when the man behind the counter at what was then called the Labour Exchange, when he said to me, can you do impressions? Well, it was a natural misunderstanding, really. Thinking that he got into his possession some kind of documentation on the recent success I'd scored at the Other Ranks Christmas concert at RAF Compton Bassett, I naturally answered, yes, I can. It was only when the address that he dispatched me to turned out to be a firm that manufactured false teeth. It was only then I realised that the impressions that he had in mind were the ones that your dentist makes with that pink kind of waxy stuff that he crams over your gums in order to determine the shape of your artificial choppers. So, although I felt a bit of a nana turning up there at that factory with my Maurice Chevalier straw hat and the Marlene Dietrich wig, nevertheless, as soon as we'd sorted out the misunderstanding, I found that the work was actually rather interesting. It's true that my own contribution to it involved little more than going round the various dentists collecting these wax impressions. But what happened whenever I bought one back was that a plaster mould would be made of it. The mould would then be fitted with this special plastic stuff. And after the plastic had been baked very hard, the resulting teeth would then be placed inside a specially designed refrigerated room where they would remain for 8 days at a temperature of minus 30. Now, it was that last part of the process which had made our dentures the only ones on the market with a 50,000-mile warranty. Because at that time, it was such a startling scientific breakthrough that we used to get professors of dentistry from all over the world just coming along to our workshop to have a deco at it. But just to say, I doubt whether I would have remained apprenticed there, or to use a more appropriate word, indentured. I doubt whether I would have remained there any length of time if it hadn't been for the girl who worked as the receptionist for a certain expensive dentist in Portman Place. Her name was Eleanor, and not only was her complexion like sugared almonds, but she had a figure of the type that could drive a man 4 inches into soft ground. And what's more, there was every indication that she fancied me. And she said to me, do you know why I look forward to your coming here every day? She said to me one morning I got there. She said, because you've always got a smile for me. Now, that happened to be true in a very literal sense. Because besides picking up the wax impressions from her, she was the one to whom I surrendered the daily deliveries of sets of dentures, you see. But while I was still reeling under the impact of this unmistakable encouragement, she lowered her voice and said, why don't you pop back this evening after surgery hours? Which I did. Now, what transpired there, on that wide, leather-padded dentist chair, it would be neither seemly nor gentlemanly to go into any detail about in a program like this, but suffice it to say that after her dainty heel had kicked the chair to fully tilted, she stretched herself back on it full length and murmured, remember, darling, be dental with me. They always say that a chap never forgets his first time, and that's certainly true for me. Don't get me wrong, I'm not referring to Eleanor. I'm talking about the first time a chap gets charged with manslaughter. Because that's what happened, you see. The reason being that when I rushed out of the false teeth factory that evening, so overwhelmed with passion was I, I'd slammed shut the door of that refrigerated room, neglecting to check whether there was anybody inside it at the time, which there was. The 75-year-old head of the Orthodontic Research Centre at Schleswig-Holstein. And that, actually, was possibly my only bit of good fortune in the whole horrible mess, because at that period, the immediate post-war period, there was still a certain amount of residual resentment at our former enemy, so that the general feeling was that one elderly German professor one way or the other didn't really make that much. Never mind, you see. In fact, I thought the newspapers took a rather flippant tone altogether about the tragedy that resulted as a result of my error. As I remember, one of the evenings headlined it as Molar Manufacturer Glacés a Jerry. but it was one of the popular dailies, I think, phrased it most succinctly. Tooth Company Freeze a Kraut.
I thought it was a thoroughly immoral story. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Muir wins the story, and he and his teammate, Dilys Powell, also win the entire contest. And that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
My Word were Anscott James, Dilys Powell, Dennis Norton and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Longland. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Shrine.